Hello. Welcome.
Remember we had that caucus.
This is Senate File 3735.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 3735 seeks to expand the Living at Home Block Nurse Program with nine additional sites. Well, I thought it was nine. Looks like it's more than that on the bill here. But, it does that by asking for a transfer of some dollars from the Community Service Grant Program. You can see that at the bottom of page two on the A1 amendment. But with me this morning are Lee Greenfield and Malcolm Mitchell, and we'll ask them to give you a little feedback on the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lee Greenfield. I am the chair of the board of the Elderberry Institute, which is the statewide organization for the Living at Home Block Nurse Programs. Elderberry Institute and our Living at Home Block Nurse Programs, there are 40, soon to be 42 of them, a nonprofit, community-owned and operated programs providing services to all elders that keep them living in their communities and at home. These programs organize nursing care and volunteer assistance to provide the required services to accomplish this. The current 40 programs in the 06-07 year provided services to 11,578 Minnesota elders at home. Neighborhood volunteers provided more than 108,000 hours of volunteer service to those people. Currently, 31 of these programs receive base funding from the Department of Human Services of $20,000 per year. The other programs have to apply for one-year grants from the department, which are time-limited to a maximum of 5 years. A number of the programs are reaching this time limit. Also, the Community Service Development, CSD grants, on December 31st issued an RFP which allows proposals to use the funds only to support systems change and or capital and renovation projects, not ongoing community service, which is what these programs are about. The amendment that you have before you to the bill would provide one-time funds for each of the programs that do not have base funding, transferred only once in fiscal year 09 to these projects. In the last fiscal year, these programs in grants had received $222,000 from the CSSD funds. This would assure the funding for these programs and allow them to continue the services to the elders in their community. There would be no additional cost to the states because it would be transferred from the grant funds once to make sure that they continue providing community service for this population. Malcolm Mitchell, who's the executive director of the program of Elderberry Institute, had a few other background words.
Good morning, members of the committee. I am the executive director of Elderberry Institute. We are a statewide resource whose primary mission is to assist communities, neighborhoods and communities throughout the state to develop and sustain their own Living at Home Block Nurse programs. And I'd just like to say a couple things in addition to the data that Mr. Greenfield just gave you. One is that this model is very consistent with the Transform 2010 agenda of the Department of Human Services and the legislature, with a focus on helping to support home and community-based services as an alternative to the use of more expensive assisted living and nursing home services, and a way to build that activity in the local community. This program is unique in several ways. One, it is a neighborhood or a community that organizes it as their own nonprofit corporation. It's not a large corporation with a central office. It is each community owning it themselves. It is also a generalist. It is there to help any elder who is in that community who needs some help, and it's not a defined set of services as much as it is a generalist approach to saying whatever that person needs, we will provide or arrange. So it's a linking kind of connecting organization. And the other piece I'd like to emphasize, it's a problem-solving approach. It is sitting down in a trusted relationship with an elder in their own community and saying, what are you doing for yourself? What are your family doing for you? How can we help you? What is the kind of support that you need? And it's tailored specifically to that individual and any individual who needs it. So it's not limited by eligibility to medical assistance and Medicare. It is a community reaching out to build a commitment for its own elders in its own community. And it's lower cost. We find, and in the data we provide, that it's for about $500 a year, we can provide that assistance to most people, even if they need ongoing nursing services. And this program, as part of the model, combines a very comprehensive approach from, you know, telephone reassurance in the home to, if they are frail and need home care, each community contracts with a Medicare-certified home care agency, and through that contract with the home care agency is there as, again, a comprehensive approach to assist that elder and their family in home, and particularly to look at the needs of the caregiver at the same time. So it is heavily oriented toward the use of volunteers. And as Lee said, there's last year the 40 programs provided about 108,000 hours of volunteer time. If we had to pay for those as a state resource, we'd have to pay about for 52 full-time equivalents. It's a very practical, I'd say a successful partial solution to the moving forward of the mm-hmm. population, which is aging in this state. And we are here, hope you'll urge you to support this legislation. It would allow up to 12 new programs, all of which are already operating or nearly operating, to have a ongoing for fiscal year, at least for fiscal year 2009, a solid money in which to leverage other local dollars. For every dollar invested, each community generates another about $2.50 of other money that it brings in using the state money as a leverage tool.
Members, we have a quorum now, and Senator Kubley has a delete everything amendment for his bill. And so Senator Rosen will move adoption of the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now, members, you need to understand that this money that they're asking for 1 year has RFPs going that have been let by the department for new organizations to get this money. So I think just so we can be safe about what we're trying to do here, is there someone from the department that can come up and just kind of let us know if...
Madam Chair, Rolf Haig, Department of Human Services, and your question is?
Well, the question is the money that they want on a one-time basis to give them kind of a soft landing off of these funds that they've been receiving in the past. Are those dollars actually committed to anybody yet?
No, there's currently an RFP. The RFP that Mr. Greenfield referred to was published December 31st. The applications have closed for that RFP, but there have been no selections and no contracts let for those funds.
And if we did this bill, would there be any new organizations that would be able to be funded in this round?
Actually, many of the organizations applying under this RFP are organizations that currently receive community services development grants.
Right, but the whole concept of it is to get new services that are needed started, but not to fund them forever. So I'm assuming every time you let an RFP out, that there are a number of organizations that would be applying for the first time.
There are, but...
And so the question is, if you fund the ones that are have been funded in the past that are still eligible to continue receiving funding, and we do this bill, is there anything left for any new organizations coming forward?
The short answer to the question is yes.
Okay.
Having said that, just as a point of information, eight of the Living at Home Block Nurse programs that have in the past been funded but are not base programs have made applications under the current RFP.
Any other questions? Senator Rosen.
I'd like to move the bill, please.
Senator Rosen would move then that Senate file 3735 as amended be recommended to pass.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Is Senator Latz here? No. Senator Dahl? I saw Senator Dahl.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, we heard this in health policy a couple weeks ago. This is the dental loan forgiveness bill and scholarship program, and really it's, I consider it a oral health access bill to expand the amount of dentists we can get into critical access areas and underserved areas of the state, providing more money into the scholarship program and with a three-year provision that they would work in these areas, and also reducing the amount of low-income patients that they would be serving in a year. I brought Dominic Sposito with me to go over some details and answer any questions, and I'd like to turn it over to him at this point.
We have an amendment, Senator Dahl, and so why don't we see if we can get the amendment before us. Senator Sharon will move the adoption of the amendment. And we've taken most of this bill into Senate File 3099, so this amendment is kind of what Senator Dahl has left of his bill. And so I believe what is left is the study about contracting.
Correct. Yes, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions about the amendment? Seeing none, then those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now, Senator Dahl, is the department going to be able to absorb this study?
My understanding, Madam Chair, that we had discussions with the department. They want to do this study, and I don't know if it's clear that they have all the resources, but they had indicated to us that they would like to do this study, that and move forward with it.
Is there someone here from the department?
Chris Reisdorf from the Department of Human Services. We have put $100,000 on the House side for this study. We feel that needs a comprehensive review, and that we don't have the staff reserves right now to do a comprehensive study.
Senator Dahl, I think we're going to have to lay your bill over. I don't have $100,000. I don't have 1 cent. So why don't we lay your bill over and see if you can talk with the department about if there's things you could do to raise money for the study outside of government, or if there's ways you can scope the study down so that they could absorb it.
Okay. Very good.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I wonder if before we make that motion, I have an amendment that perhaps could be considered.
Well, it could be, but we're laying the bill over. So you might want to wait with your amendment until we see if we can bring it back.
Okay.
Thank you.
If you let me know if you're able to work this out this morning, and we'll take your bill back up.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Lori.
I'm a little insecure about my numbers. Just since.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We've got Senate File 3245, Administrative Simplification. Changes to some of the legislation we adopted last year. Admin costs have been a concern to the Health Committee and the legislature for many years, and of course last year we did a fairly aggressive uniform billing requirements. I think that it's pretty familiar ground to us that billings and claims processing cost the overall health care system over $750 million per year. And the legislation that we did last year requiring all health care providers and all health care payers to implement uniform billing transactions around three high-volume common transactions will save the overall health care system between $60 and $70 million per year. But there were a few things that we needed to tweak in the legislation, and this bill is intended to do that. I should also say that there's been literally thousands of person hours spent by the department and the industry throughout the whole period between when this came up last year and now, and they're really making phenomenal progress toward the overall goals of electronics claims processing. But this bill does three things, really. The first thing is technical corrections, updating sections that were enacted prior to last year. These changes keep the language current with national standards. They come as recommendations from the Administrative Uniformity Committee. A second change provides the Commissioner of Health the authority to issue temporary exemption for workers' comp, property casualty, or auto carriers from requirements that currently do not meet their needs. This is kind of at the core. There are these providers that simply these payers that simply can't participate in one of the three transactions that were required under last year's legislation. And the third thing is it provides a complaint-driven compliance mechanism for the Department of Health to ensure cooperation. I think there's a fact sheet from the Department of Health that should step through line items. We do have a fiscal note with that demonstrates that there are no general fund costs associated with this. I think over the next three fiscal years, 09, 10, and 11, there's about $10,000 generated, again, across those 3 years into a special revenue fund that will be then reinvested in technical assistance to assist those that are struggling to comply with the regs to be able to do so. So it's a very minimal fiscal impact, and zero to the general fund, a very small amount from the compliance piece.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Pretner-Solon.
Senator Lurie, I don't see your fact sheet. Was there a fiscal note on this? Or
There is a fiscal note.
I didn't see that either.
Sorry.
It's being printed right now.
Okay.
We've been working hard, folks, and we're just having a little trouble sometimes keeping up. We are not always getting the fiscal notes in a very timely fashion either. But the only reason this bill is here is because of the ability of the department in the bill to levy fines.
Okay.
And then the bill appropriates the fine money to the department if there are any fines that are ever levied. And so because that appropriation is in here, the bill has to be here. Senator Lori, I do have one question, though, and I know this issue came up in the policy committee, and some folks have had a little bit more discussion with me about it, and that is that apparently the language in the bill leaves open to rulemaking the question of whether auto and workers' comp should be done, their medical should be done on a uniform basis or not. And I know that you plan to do that, so then the question is, why would you leave the language in the bill up to having a rulemaking fight about it?
Madam Chair, I think what you're referring to is the fact that the bill says that the department has the authority to exempt these three carriers from claims and eligibility processing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and the issue is really around, and there has been a good deal of discussion about this. The issue is around that term of art, claims and eligibility, which again, which links back to other sections of law. It is a term of art, and there was some discomfort with that because really there were three claims transactions that we covered last year. Eligibility, which it is these three provider types of payers are unable to participate in the eligibility transactions.
Right, and then we understand that.
Okay. And so it says claims and eligibility in the file, I mean in the bill, but I also did get a letter from signed by Scott Leitz, the assistant commissioner, that very clearly steps through any exemptions must be based on one of two criteria. The criteria, the transaction must be incapable of exchange, or another national electronic transaction standard would be more appropriate and effective. It goes on and talks about...
I do believe that's what they intend to do.
Mm-hmm.
But by leaving the language in the bill, as vague as it is, I believe will leave the department open to having a more protracted rulemaking process, because other people will read it to say, oh, well, we can have our claims exempted from this, not just our eligibility.
I have Jim Golden from the department.
Welcome, Mr. Golden.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden with the Minnesota Department of Health. Madam Chair, in this instance, we don't believe that the commissioner actually has very much authority. We believe that the two criteria are more or less black and white. In the first criteria, it is whether or not the transaction is capable of moving the data that is necessary. That is a determination that has been made collectively by the department and the Minnesota Administrative Uniformity Committee. It has already been finished for the purposes of eligibility, and we have determined at this time it does not work. That same determination has been made for healthcare claims, and we have determined that it does work, so that providers would be able to use the standard claim when sending to workers' compensation. There is another transaction, which is the remittance advice. We are currently in the process of working with all of the industry providers, as well as the work comp carriers and other types of carriers, to determine if that works. What we have said in the letter is that, as of this point, we see no reason why it does not work. We are aware that there is a small issue with a code set. That particular issue is resolved quarterly at the national level. It simply requires a request. And so what this language does is provides flexibility just to make sure that we have sufficient time to be able to do that. The other thing that the language does is something that we think is also very consistent with administrative savings. It provides the opportunity to use another national standard if that national standard would be more appropriate. At this point, there's not one for claims. Claims would be the exact same one that is used in all other situations, but we do anticipate something like that in eligibility. So I think, as Senator Lurie was saying, the real purpose is to tie to the section above, and should the legislature decide to add additional transactions in the future, it would continue to tie those out.
Any other questions? If not, then Senator Lurie, do you want to make your motion?
I move that Senate File 3245 be recommended to pass.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. I think Senator Dahl is ready to come back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's amazing what happens when you go out into the hallway and find some loose change on the floor.
Well, let me know. I'm ready to run right out there.
What I'd like to offer, Madam Chair, and the language here to address this issue is, and have someone in the committee possibly offer this, is to, the wording would be to, at the beginning of line 1.4 in this amendment, to read, to the extent that resources are available.
Okay, would someone like to make that motion? Senator Sharon moves that amendment to the A5 amendment that's been adopted. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Now, I think that will, I'm not sure what they'll do for you, but at least you'll have it on their agenda over at DHS.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch, you said you had an amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I would like to offer the A2 amendment.
This kind of looks like the bill we had on the agenda today, but we had to take it off because we actually don't have the bill in the Finance Committee. Senator Lynch, do you want to explain the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl, this amendment started out in a form called Senate File 249, and just by reference of the number, this was a bill that was introduced last session. And frankly, the issue at hand centers around how we deal with graduates of dental programs that are non-accredited, i.e., traditionally outside of this country. And when the various stakeholders came to me, frankly, there were lots of opinions on this particular matter, and I encouraged them to continue to work amongst themselves to come up with something that everyone felt was satisfactory. That was about 22 months ago, I think. So I'm very pleased to bring this forward today because I view this as a compromise agreement that's been reached that will do a number of things. I think it will provide the assurance that we're looking for to make sure that these individuals are trained in a manner that's consistent with the expectations that we have in this country and in this state. And it also provides a mechanism so that we can utilize these individuals who have been properly trained to further address the needs that we have in oral health.
Okay, now this has not actually had a hearing in the Policy Committee, I don't believe. So I'm going to ask if there are people that would like to testify on this amendment. Is the amendment acceptable to you, Senator Dahl?
Madam Chair, thank you. Members, I understand that there was an agreement, but the only contentious area that I have with this is the number of years. I think the original agreement was for 3 years, and I was comfortable with the 3 years. I think I think it's important that people make a commitment to this, and I would prefer that we look at a 3-year commitment as was originally agreed to rather than the 2 years.
Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, and for members, that reference is on line 1.12 and again on 1.15 and 1.17. I would be open to the further discussion and the will of the committee in that regard. I think that we are trying to come up with something that is deemed workable by all, and I don't have any strong opinions on that one way or the other.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Lynch. Following your proposal, if the applicant works for 2 years and the dentist is not satisfied to recommend them and the board, then what do they do? Do they just roll over for another 2-year extension, or does it go yearly? Because that might affect the 2 to 3 year, in my opinion. If the applicant is not ready at the end of 2 years, I'm not sure what happens, rather than locking everyone into a 3-year obligation.
Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson-Robes, I'm not sure exactly what the question is.
The question is, during this 2-year period that this dentist is being supervised, if they're not performing satisfactorily so that they're not going to be recommended to be granted this unlimited license, what happens to them?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, do they roll back into another 2 years?
Or do they continue to be supervised then for another 2 years to see if they can improve their skills during that time, or are they just not, after 2 years, then they're out, they don't get to be licensed?
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Esposito could answer or take a shot
Spizzetto?
At this one.
Madam Chairman, Dominic Spizzetto, representing the Minnesota Dental Association. It's our understanding, again, we're going somewhere that's never gone before, so we're kind of working without a safety net here, but it's our understanding that if after that 2 or 3 year period in which they were granted a limited license and that period expired and they had not met the tenets of the recommendations from the supervisors or the disciplinary actions, that they would no longer have a license to practice in the state.
So then maybe it would be better to have it be a 3-year period so that if someone just needs a little more time to, you know, refine their skills, they would have it.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I would I agree with the explanation that Mr. Spizzetto has given I don't know if there's a formal amendment on the floor, but.
Yeah, it's your amendment.
Regarding the 2 to 3.
Well, you can amend your amendment if you choose to, or someone else can amend your amendment if they choose to. You can incorporate it into your amendment. It hasn't been adopted if you want to make that change. Senator Prettner-Solon?
Madam Chair, I would amend the amendment in the three places where it says 2 years to reflect 3 years instead.
Any discussion of that? No discussion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now, is there any more discussion about the amendment as amended? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I would just offer that if it would be the will of the chair and the committee, Jonathan Watson from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers is here and would be prepared to make a short statement.
All right. Well, we are taking testimony on this, so.
Good
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name again is Jonathan Watson. I'm from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We serve about 41,000, or we provided dental services to about 41,000 dental patients in the last year. Roughly 50% of those are on Medicaid and 50% are uninsured. I'm here to support the A2 amendment for foreign trained dentists offered by Senator Lynch. What we found in community health centers is a barrier to care is often cultural and language. Roughly 70% of our patients are not white. 28% of our patients are best served in English, a language other than English. So we've used the foreign trained dentist program over the years since its inception. We've employed roughly 8 or 9 dentists over the course of the time in order to break down those barriers to care. They're in a lot of the urban areas of the state, and we also have them in rural areas of the state. We have a dentist from India who practices in Floodwood, Minnesota, and the community there really appreciates him. And when we kind of talk about patient satisfaction, 94% of our patients say they're satisfied that they were cared for in a culturally appropriate way. So in general, the need for dentists is, I think, well-documented in the state. At our community health centers, Lake Superior Community Health Center in Duluth, the waiting list is about 8 to 12 months to get a dental appointment. And Open Door in Mankato, Minnesota, they have about a 242-person wait list in terms of getting dental services. Many of those folks are driving up to the cities for care. So I believe that the amendment, again, maintains access, especially for the populations that we serve in terms of dental care. I'd be available for any questions. Thank you.
Questions. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because there hasn't been a policy hearing on this, I'm going to ask just a little bit more background because this isn't something I know much about. I know, for example, for lawyers, that one of the requirements for licensure is we have to graduate from an accredited law school. But I also know that we probably don't have a need for more lawyers as compared to more dentists and doctors. So maybe we need to look at this differently. But I don't know much about the foreign trained dentist program that you spoke about, and I wonder if you could tell me what the difference is between that program and this amendment and what the extension might be. And how our state licensed dentists feel about this amendment?
Madam Chairman, I'll take a shot at that.
Mr. Spezzato.
I believe it was 2001, as part of a dental access initiative that the Dental Association worked with the legislature on, there was an opportunity to provide a dentist to a rural community, but the dentist hadn't graduated from an accredited program in the United States. And Senator Olson is correct. All states in this country require that you graduate from an accredited program as a condition of licensure. We thought in an attempt to assist that particular clinic, we would waive that requirement and give the Board of Dentistry the authority to decide whether their training had been appropriate or equivalent to those that would be in an accredited program. Frankly, we didn't know what we were doing. And we didn't realize that in India there are some 600 dental programs, and that there are several thousand dental programs throughout the country, that the Board of Dentistry has no idea about the curricula without going there, doing a site visit, studying the information. And we've also found that the curricula and the requirements are different from every country. When you think about Australia and Canada and Great Britain and in Western Europe, the dental education is somewhat equivalent. But when you go beyond that, there's a wide variety. So we opened up the door, and interestingly, there were a lot of foreign dentists that wanted to come and practice in the United States and used Minnesota as a way to enter into that because we were the only state that authorized a non-accredited foreign-trained dentist to be licensed. There wasn't any criteria, and frankly, there wasn't really a program. It was just whether the Board of Dentistry decided whether or not this was an appropriate equivalent education. And not having the capability to do it, they were on the lenient side, and we had several dentists came out. I think there was 130-some in the first 2 or 3 years of this program. We also found out that it wasn't a requirement that they practice in Minnesota. So there was a possibility for foreign-trained dentists to get a license here and then practice in other parts of the country. However, they couldn't get a license in any other state because all the states have the requirement that you graduate from an accredited program. However, they could go into the Foreign Service or Public Health or any sort of federal program, Indian Health Service, that doesn't require that particular accreditation. So what this is trying to do is to sort of limit this. In a way, it's a way to protect us to make sure that we're getting foreign-trained dentists who come here and actually practice in Minnesota, and a way to sort of oversee their practice to make sure that whether or not they have equivalent education, they can do what they need to do and serve the public in the best interest of the dental care system.
Right. And, Senator Olson, the amendment does say that they have to successfully complete the clinical licensure examination. So, you know, they would have to meet the standards we have here to be in this program. Are there other questions? Senator Corning.
Madam Chair, I would just say no question. Just, you know, this hasn't been vetted through the policy committee, and I guess that's fine, but I would just point out that if when I bring an amendment forward that hasn't been vetted through, I'm going to bring this up and say that
Well, apparently this agreement has been reached fairly late in the session, and I know because the session time frames are so compressed, it's making sometimes things difficult.
Right, but I would just this kind of just sets a precedent so that when I have an amendment that I'll be able...
I understand, Senator Corey.
I'm just trying to work through the process that we all have set up here, so thank you.
This does happen occasionally, yes. Any other questions? If not, those in favor of the A2 amendment as amended, indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. Any other questions on Senate File 3122?
Madam Chair, in the language, as I understand that we have currently, there's a section in here that really is unnecessary based on actions of the last. Is that gone? Okay, I'm mistaken.
We picked up most of your bill, Senator Dahl, in 3099 because you had the scholarships in your bill, and we needed to pay for those. So we have paid for them in Senate File 3099 out of the Health Care Access Fund. And as long as we were doing that, we thought it only made sense to pick up the language that would make the loan forgiveness program more consistent with the critical access dental program. So all of that has been taken care of. What you have left in this bill is just the study.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions on Senate File 3122? Senator Lynch moves that Senate File 3122 as amended be recommended to pass. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Chair, members.
All right, then... Is Senator Latz here?
Yes.
Let's take your Senate File 2795 next.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Shall I proceed, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Senate File 2795 is an initiative of the Minnesota State Bar Association Real Property Section. I have with me here Julian Zwaber from the Zwaber Law Firm. He's also representing the Elder Law Section of the State Bar Association to answer your questions. There are a couple of provisions in this bill, and I understand that, Madam Chair, you wanted to see the bill in your division because there was some concern about whether or not there would be a fiscal impact on the Department of Human Services in connection, I think, is with M.A. Liens. We do have an amendment that we'd like to have added to the bill, which should address those concerns so there would be a zero fiscal impact. And this amendment was negotiated between the Bar Association, Mr. Zwaber in particular, and the Department of Human Services.
Okay, I guess the amendment's being distributed.
Thank you.
Mr. Godfrey indicates to me that he's spoken with the department, and in fact, the amendment does remove the fiscal impact. It's sometimes a little difficult because we get the fiscal notes on the bills as they come to our committee, and sometimes then we don't actually have an official fiscal note on an amendment. But we are told by the department that this will remove the fiscal impact, and so there would be a fiscal note on the amended bill for the full finance committee. So this is an amendment that removes sections of the bill that relate to medical assistance.
I'll ask Mr. Zweber to explain the contents of the amendment, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julian Zweber. I'm an attorney in St. Paul. Actually, I've been a member of the Real Property Section Legislative Committee for the last 19 years and was involved in drafting the contents of the basic bill and this amendment with the Department of Human Services. This amendment clarifies what happens after the person who has signed the deed to transfer title on death dies. It requires that a clearance certificate from the Department of Human Services be filed in every county in which the property described in the deed is located. It basically clarification language, making it clear that the transfer on death deed does not affect the medical assistance claims or liens against the property. Title passes subject to those claims, and the rest of this is how do we file paperwork to show how that's being handled. In effect, every transfer on death deed will require a clearance certificate from the county agency, and that will have to be placed of record to show that the medical assistance claims and liens have been settled or otherwise adjusted to permit transfer of marketable title to the property.
Any questions? Senator Sharon moves adoption of the amendment for Senator Latz. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Any other questions on the bill? If not, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 2795, as amended, be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you. Madam Chair, does it go to full finance from here then?
Yes, it will be. The next stop would be in full finance.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 3005, and I think most of you have heard that this bill already, with the exception perhaps of Senators Olson, Sharon, and Rosen. It has had hearings in the Policy Committee as well as the Education Policy Committee. Although it has, I do have an amendment. Basically, what this bill does is it talks about distribution of information and regarding vaccines. And the American Cancer Society states that vaccines have a history of remarkable success and are one of the most important public health tools worldwide. This is a method of prevention, and this is a cost savings to our healthcare system. They also state that information about vaccines should be readily available to the public, and the vaccine must be supported by the medical community. And both are true in the case of this bill. The two vaccines in this bill, meningococcal and HPV, both dramatically improve the health and longevity of young people today. I don't know that I need to go into all the details about the HPV or meningococcal. Basically, what this bill does is it the Department of Health already has information printed and available, as well as a website. It requests that the schools in grades 6, 9, or 12 provide information if and when they send a mailing or disseminate information to parents, and that at least they just put the website on their or the web address on their website, the information on their website. There was some objection at one time by the nurses, the school nurses. I have an amendment that I believe they are neutral on now, and that is the A4 amendment, and I'd like to offer that.
So we need to distribute the A4 amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
While that's being, could I just ask a question while that's being distributed? Senator Prettner-Solon, are you envisioning that this information would be distributed by a mailing from the school to parents or by something sent home with students? Or how would you envision that this would work?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
At one time, this was prescriptive. Right now, with the new language and the amendment, it's left open to the schools to disseminate if and however they wish to do that.
So we have the A4 amendment. Senator Prettner-Solon moves the amendment. I believe this amendment does just what she said.
Yes.
To make this voluntary on the part of school districts. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon. So that I'm understanding this. So this is, I guess I would classify this is kind of enabling legislation. It gives districts the option to do this?
It does. It reminds them that information is available. It asks them to consider sending this information to the parents of their students, and it also asks that they at least post the information on their department website.
Any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. So I think the fiscal note on this says that the department can absorb whatever the costs are because they're already doing this.
Yes.
And I think it says that there's no cost to the Department of Education. And originally there was costs that would have to be absorbed by the school districts, but now with this amendment, those costs would be optional.
Right.
Any other questions?
May I?
Senator Sharon.
I do have a question, just a curiosity. The issue around being voluntary, was it a fiscal issue?
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
It actually was a fiscal issue, even though it should not have cost the school district or the school itself more than $399 is what we figured it would cost, plus
just the paper,
some staff
to run
time.
It off of the website.
Right. $3.99.
That's for very sure. Frustrating to me. I suspect that's why Senator Lynch voted against it out of frustration. But, I mean, this is a phenomenally important public health piece of information. And, you know, our community, many of yours as well, have had young people die as a result of meningitis. This is a way to really have a significant impact. It costs very little, so that's very discouraging to me. I hope the school districts find a way to make this information available to the public. It doesn't require anybody to do anything. It just allows people to know options that they have to protect their children.
Madam Chair, this morning I received
Senator
an email from one of your constituents, actually, whose son contracted meningitis, and the mother said that three times she brought her son to the ER and they sent him home thinking that it was the flu, and she wished that she had had the vaccine for her son.
Any other discussion? You want to make your motion then, Senator?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 3005 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the floor.
We'll go to the Finance Committee.
Oh, okay. Okay, Finance.
Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
I believe that completes our agenda for today. I thank you all, and we will be having more hearings. There is, as I remind everyone, no deadline on hearing bills in the Finance Committee that are not budget bills. So if you have more bills, we're waiting for fiscal notes, trying to figure out how you can get your bill heard. With that, the meeting is adjourned.